Living Dialogues programs, Duncan, over the last 25 years have been an important part of fostering well-being and of democracy. These recurring shows over so long a period of time with the people that you have interviewed have made a difference, recognized as such. And I hope that you continue to do the Living Dialogue programs for many more years. They are an important contribution.
Welcome to this special program of Living Dialogues, the future, democracy or autocracy, here and abroad. This is actually part three of a program I've done with my friend Stefan Schwartz that played on the Friday Connections program on March 11. And part two of this program was broadcast last week on Living Dialogues on March 13. Both of those programs are available on the links, kgnu.org/connections for March 11, 2022. And kgnu.org/Living Dialogues for March 13, 2022. Today's program will be freely archive accessible as well on the link kgnu.org/Living Dialogues for today's date, March 20, 2022. Both part one and part two are full of very interesting insights, a really excellent dialogue. And as I said, Stefan is like a kind of polymath in so many different fields, a real modern Renaissance man with experience both in consciousness and science and politics and society. And our interests are very similar. As many of you know from my programs, I have been very concerned these past years with the growing crisis of our flawed democracy and its survival under great threat here in our own country. With titles of programs such as Autocracy is Coming to the USA, Democracy Requires Truth and Accountability, Democracy on the Razor's Edge. And so we now see very clearly in the world that democracy relies on an electorate informed by truth, real truth, factually based truth, and accountability for the purpose of well-being and the common good, as is the declared purpose in our founding documents of our democracy. Whereas autocracy anywhere in the world, including here in the U.S., relies on big lies and manipulating an uninformed electorate for the purpose of power. And with that, we begin now by resuming the comments Stefan was making at the end of part two regarding the urgent ongoing crisis between the forces of democracy and autocracy here in America, with the GOP and its 6-3 majority Supreme Court.
The thing about the autocrat community is that they always telegraph what they're going to do by claiming somebody else is doing it. So when you hear stuff that is ought to be seen as preposterous and yet is believed by people, you need to ask yourself, what is the real factual basis? And you can find it out. You can do a Google. You can go to Google Scholar. You can go to PubMed. There are lots of ways to get good fact-based information. And our democracy hangs by a thread because so many people in this country have been manipulated into believing utter nonsense. The autocrats who have funded these researchers who have reported on this, they have figured out that fear is the way you do it. And about 27% of the American population have overactive right amygdalas. The amygdala is a little gland about the size of an almond in your brain, and it's involved with fight or flight. And they have figured out, for instance, if you hold an election and you hold it in a church, people will vote more conservative. if you hold it in a place that has a bad smell, people will vote more conservative. If you fill people with misinformation, about 30% of them will buy it. And so what we have is an active campaign going on to use fear, the sense that something's going to happen to you, a sort of existential dread. You know, the white supremacy, when you press people who are white supremacists, what is it you think is going to happen? They talk about replacement. They talk about some vague thing that's going to happen. Their real concern is that they're somehow going to lose something in their status, although they can't really define it. But they're convinced it must be true. And so they react accordingly. You can look at the racism and the whole thing that's going on now about critical race theory. You and I talked the other day. A majority, about half the people who were part of the Constitutional Convention, were slave owners. The first five presidents of the United States, four of them were slave owners. This was baked in the destruction of the Native American communities and the fact that blacks were not even seen as full human beings. They were three-fifths of a person. It was baked into the founding of the country, and it has been an issue ever since. And what's going on now, which nobody's talking about, is that we are becoming a majority-minority country. That's just the fact. We are not going to be a white-dominant country because our birth rates are different. And more than that, we also can see that as a result of this manipulation and the fact that from a plutocrat's point of view, the only thing that matters is profit. And so what has happened in the United States is that we have transformed the country in such a way that the only social priority is profit, not well-being. If you go back and look at the original founders' thinking, they were interested in well-being. Yes, they were interested in making sure that they retained control, that they were powerful. You also see, for instance, as a result of this fear business, the breaching of the firewall between church and state. I mean, 25 years ago, the idea that you would be passing laws that exempt religious activity when it is political just would have been impossible to believe. And yet you can see that the greatest supporters of Putin are the evangelical community who have become a kind of Christian cult, not Christianity as Jesus would have taught it. I mean, they use all the biblical words, they quote biblical things, but the actuality is that this has become a community of Christo-fascists. And it is this combination of Christianity and fascism that I think is one of the most threatening aspects of the assault on democracy. We need to educate people better. Another thing that's going on is that our public education system is very poor and getting worse. And now we have people trying to control what can be taught. There's a bill that was just introduced in which they would arrest librarians for having books in their collection that offend the Christo-fascists. It's astonishing to think about that. I mean, you think about 1984, or you think about the Nazis and the burning of books. We've got people advocating book burning again and arresting and imprisoning librarians for having novels that have won Pulitzer Prizes because it offends the Christo-fascists. So I think that what is going on in the Ukraine and what's going on with Russia is a disaster for the Ukrainians, of course, and is going to be a disaster for the Russians, but it is also a wake-up call for Americans. I think that we need to wake up about a third of the country to recognize why democracy is so important. And the reason is because democracy requires agreement and consensus, whereas autocracy, one man like Vladimir Putin, who can destroy not only another country, but his own country, because there's no one there to stop him. Democracy is the only way you avoid wars like this. It is the only way that you create fairness and a just legal system. All of those things that we used to value and that people used to look at America, as Ronald Reagan said, the shining city on the hill. We don't look that way anymore. And if you look at the international polls that are going on, people don't have much respect for the United States anymore. They don't think of us as the shining city on the hill. They think of us as a flawed democracy. We are a flawed democracy. We are ranked 27th in the world amongst democratic countries. We don't have the kind of stature that we had 30 years ago. We came out of the Second World War as the world leader. We helped rebuild with the Marshall Plan. We helped rebuild Europe. People look to us for help and support for democracy. They don't do that any longer. And the reason that they are not doing this is because of the assault that is being carried out by the white supremacist, Christo-fascist, male-dominant in the government. And I think it's also quite notable that when you look at the kind of idiots that are in the Congress, and you wonder, how does a Marjorie Taylor Greene get elected? And then you find out who funded her, you realize that the fascist oligarchs, they want morons in the Congress because they can rent them as needed to do what they want. You don't see statesmen being backed by oligarchs and by plutocrats. Why? Because those people actually have ethics and are not easily rentable. Whereas the others are easy. You know, you just donate a lot of money to their politics. What we don't realize and what needs to be reversed is that Citizens United legalized bribery. It is legal to bribe politicians. I mean, that's not what they call it, of course, but that's what it is. And when you check these people that take these weird positions, what you find out is that there's some group that is funding them by giving the big donations through PACs and dark money and all the rest of it. All of that needs to be fixed. And I hope that what's going to come out of the Russian-Ukraine shift is America awakens to the importance of its democracy and steps up, and we begin to do what needs to be done to make well-being our major social priority and not profit. It's not that I'm against profit. You can make all the profits you want. You just have to do it making sure that the first thing that it produces is well-being at every level, from the bacteria in the soil to the birds and bees and butterflies. I mean, you look at what is happening, the collapse of ecosystems, the collapse of the bees. 70% of the food we eat depends on bees, and yet we are permitting corporations to sell chemical pesticides like Roundup, which kill bees. That's because profit is more important than well-being in the United States, and that is what has to be reversed.
I think that says it extraordinarily well. It's what was called, actually, from an indigenous point of view, way back when colonial capitalism came to these shores, centuries ago, the native peoples here had a way of living and sharing wealth and having different allocated responsibilities, medicine men, hunters. Everyone had a respected role within the tribe. And when the conquistadores came here under the sanction of the Catholic Church and the doctrine of discovery, which treated indigenous people specifically in the papal bull of 1493, saying that these people, they're savages, as referred to by Jefferson in the Declaration of Independence, which I quoted before, have no soul. They are subhumans, and therefore it was the Christian duty of the conquistadores coming as, you might say, capitalist colonists to this country and to all of North and South America to enslave these people and to take all of their wealth, and if they refused, to kill them. So this is a topic for another time. I think you put it beautifully, Stefan, because this sort of violence of the spirit and this greed of appropriation, the church called it gold glory, bring gold and glory back from your perilous journeys overseas and give it to the crown and this church. But basically that whole psyche, very religiously influenced, not humanely influenced, was called wetiko. It's a kind of sickness of the soul that has never really been expunged in all of our history and is now showing up in all the ways that you have so specifically identified. And we go back to FDR's second inaugural address, the last time an attempt to cure capitalism in its late stages of itself after the Great Depression. He said in his second inaugural address that we all know that the pursuit of heedless self-interest, greed, is bad morality. Now we also know that it is bad economics. And he went on to say that whenever the private sector becomes more powerful than government, which is government of the people, by the people, for the people, that is fascism. So when you talk about Christo-fascism at this point, Stefan, I think it harkens back to that whole unearthed and unprocessed history, which Joseph Ellis, sometimes called the Founder's Historian, who's written books and won awards, Pulitzer Prize and National Book Award for his work on Washington, Jefferson, and the Founding Brothers. He wrote a book called American Creation. I've done numerous dialogues with him. And in that book, he talked about the two original sins of America were the genocide of the Native Americans, which has never been accounted for, and the slavery of the African Americans, which has been stutter-stepped all the way forward until the Voting Rights Act in 65, the Civil Rights Act in 64, only to have Justice Roberts, a Republican, actually a right-winger, improperly called a conservative, to completely gut the 1965 Voting Rights Act. And then in 2019, he wrote an opinion that said the Supreme Court cannot interfere with political gerrymandering. So what we see now with this 6-3 Supreme Court and with the prospect of the Republican Party taking over as a minority party with its already announced agenda to take away the benefits for children and people with lower means and to, again, try to get rid of Obamacare. This has been announced finally by Mitch McConnell as their agenda. It's more extreme than ever, and they're now in a position to do so unless we can have a huge uprising between now and November election in this particular year. I think people like you and I, elders, and Bill McKibben, elders, with his third act proposal now to get people over 60 to become really active in politics and fight for our democracy. It's a conclusion, really, of what's going on in Ukraine, where the men between 18 and 60 are required, elders and youth, to inform each other with the passion of youth and the experience of elders in this elder-youth dialogue and activism that I personally have been championing since 1963, when this concept of youth 18 to 30 was introduced for the first time by the psychological historian Erik Erikson. So he said, unless there's an active mutually respective and informed co-creative dialogue between elders and youth, no civilization can survive, much less thrive. I believe you've made a wonderful and very deep contribution to this in your work throughout your life, and I've done a parallel in my work with Living Dialogue. So I want to say to people that I urge you to go to schwartzreport.net and sign up for the freely available daily contribution that Stefan passionately makes every day to fact-based truth. And so, Stefan, I want to say for all your life committed to these values of well-being, the common good, and democracy, just with great gratitude, just appreciate these dialogues that we've done together.
My pleasure. I'm glad to participate, and I hope that people that are hearing this will recognize that the choices that they make every day either support continuation of this kleptocratic oligarchical system, or they support well-being. Just make every choice be in support of fostering well-being. And if you do that, I'm just hoping that we will see why democracy is so important.
And really, it's the path forward for an interconnectedness of everything on the planet. And by that, we don't mean only our anthropocentric activity, but going back to that indigenous experience as described by anthropologists when we were in our indigenous period before we started the modern mind, which is still in its adolescent mode. And variously, people start that from agriculture or urbanization when people did not know or see the faces of everybody they were relating to in the tribe. And so that was described as participatio mystique, or mystical participation. When they wanted to say it in a certain way, they would use the French. But nonetheless, what they described was an experience of our ancestors, which is our right as humans. The first humans experienced themselves as being embedded and looked after and participating in a fully alive consciousness in the cosmos, so that the stars were alive, the wandering stars, as they're called. We know Vedic astrology actually penetrated these secrets of the interrelationship between seemingly inanimate objects and seemingly inanimate land. And the animals looked down upon as not being fully, quote, at the level of human. In fact, the animals and the land itself and the plants are all part of a celebration of life in the cosmos that we can actually tune into when we set our intention, as you describe, even in our quotidian choices to choose what is life-enhancing, choose well-being, choose common good. And this, as the Dalai Lama has said, is what produces happiness. He said all beings just want to be happy, and the way they can do it is in service. So he talked about this kind of wisdom that arises out of compassion and interacting in a way which is both respectful and sharing others' experience. So again, as we're now coming to the end of this series, I want to just again put out the call for people to pay attention, really pay attention, and do your own research and see the deeper issues that are incredibly at stake in the next 9 months, because after these next elections, there may be nothing happening in the way of the substance of democracy, nothing happening with the way of legislation being passed for the common good and well-being, and indeed even a whole series of extraordinarily destructive Supreme Court opinions, which they've already signaled they are prepared to make and are talking to their right-wing base and encouraging them to bring suits, as Amy Barrett said recently, bring these suits for our next term. We've already got suits that we're going to actually deal with this term and make decisions that are very far-reaching, and we want to continue that next year. So this is what we need to be aware of. We need to make community and dialogue within our own hearts, awaken our hearts, and be with others in community. And that's what is really the inspiration for these living dialogues and for Stefan's great work in many fields, but also his daily Schwartz Report, which again, I urge everyone to sign up for by going to schwartzreport.net. So in the spirit of co-creative dialogue, again, Stefan, kudos, and it's been such a great pleasure and honor here for us to be co-visioning these kinds of encouragements that we know we all can participate in. And I've even started a series, which I'm calling Post-COVID Renaissance, of how we can create a wise and compassionate evolutionary culture.
Support what you're doing, Duncan. I think it's very important. You know, you never know when you do something like this kind of conversation. You don't know who you're going to touch. When I was a boy, I remember my fifth grade teacher, Mrs. Wright, who said to me, a parent-teacher thing, said, you know, how do you pick the kids that you're going to emphasize? And Mrs. Wright said, you never know a child, in this case, the fifth grade, you never know which one could become the president or a great scientist or a great writer. So you treat them all with everything you can to support their potential.
And I would say even beyond that, a great human being, no matter how humble in terms of status within a given society. Ours is driven exclusively by money and accumulation of money and hoarding of money, getting respect, and then people in politics supported by such people are getting titles like senator, congressman, and so on, without doing anything to actually get our soul back, the soul of democracy. And so I think well-being, yeah, as you're talking about, really is a great person. And I go back to the Dalai Lama had a wonderful phrase when he said, what we can engage in, and every single person is capable of this non-anthropocentric relationship with the universe. He said, we're happiest when we're in service, when we are in service to something other than just ourselves. He called it altruistic omniscience. A great phrase, altruistic omniscience, meaning that as we experience compassion and concern for something beyond our own ego and self, which is with us really in our subconscious gossip in our culture all the time, but as we enter that compassionate field, wisdom awakens and co-arises with the compassion. And that's what can lead us to a wise and compassionate society dedicated, as your two words recur over and over again, to the common good and well-being for all that is. And Native Americans use the phrase, all our relations, to celebrate the fact that we are in a living universe, in living dialogue with all that is, and capable of celebrating, as you do in all of your work, specifically the well-being and common good for really all that is.
I couldn't agree more.
Well, Stefan, again, such a pleasure always to be together, and let's look forward to many more of these co-creative dialogues. And with that, we thank our deep listening audience for having evoked this spontaneous discourse, this spontaneous dialogue today, because it's the third leg of the stool is the deep listening and caring, interested hearts of everybody that will hear this dialogue. I know not just today or tomorrow, but far into the future, that presence of people's human deep yearning for communication and dialogue is what is evoking the spontaneous dialogue discourse today, of course, for myself and Stefan today in our mutual dialogue. So it's really a trialogue with honor and appreciation and love and celebration for all of our deep listeners. Be with us next time on Living Dialogues.